The Indian government is making two groups of farmers very angry at the moment. Let's start here in Australia, where sugar farmers are urging the Australian government to make a formal complaint against the Indian government for a recently announced support package for its sugar industry. Nationals MP Keith Pitt says there's enough grounds for the move if other major sugar producers, like Brazil, sign on.
As a former Assistant Minister for Trade, I can tell you that WTO actions are not undertaken lightly, but I think in this circumstance it's time. I think there does need to be action.
Depending on the season, India's usually either the biggest or the second biggest sugar producer, and two bumper crops have been a major force behind the sugar price slumping to a 10-year low this year. This week, some 50,000 farmers, mainly from the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, marched on the capital New Delhi. They're furious at the slump in commodity prices and the roughly $440 million they're collectively owed in payments from the country's sugar mills. In September, the Modi government announced an intervention package for the sugar industry worth $1.3 billion and set a minimum floor price for sugar below the cost of production. Devinder Sharma is a respected agricultural economist and says Indian farmers have suffered for decades at the hands of bad agricultural policy designed to keep food prices low.
We need to understand that Indian agriculture is undergoing a terrible, terrible crisis. And this agrarian distress is the outcome of the kind of policies that have been followed for at least the last four decades. A recent OECD study, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development study, has said that farm incomes in India had remained frozen for two decades.
Devinder Sharma says farmer protests against the government have escalated in recent years. In the protest that ended on Wednesday night, police lobbed tear gas into the 50,000-strong crowd and used water cannons to hold protesters back, a move that angered many as the country marked Mahatma Gandhi Memorial Day.
That was very unfortunate, happening on Mahatma Gandhi's birth anniversary. Very, very sad indeed. And this protest march is not the only one. We have had number of protest demonstrations this year again. So for the last 4 years, the number of protests have actually multiplied. The official data will be coming later, but between 2014 and 2016, it had multiplied by seven times. There are roughly about 20 protests happening every day in India. Somewhere or the other.
In Australia, the Sugar Milling Council's David Rinn says there's a clear case from their point of view that the rules set by the World Trade Organization have been broken.
Now is the time for action. Letters have been exchanged at the highest levels between the Australian government and the Indian government. Discussions have been had in WTO, in Geneva. Obviously, with the announcement of this package the other night by the Indian government, these massive subsidies, much bigger than we anticipated.
Devinder Sharma says while there's a lively debate in India about the extent to which the sugar industry in particular is pampered, there's also a sense among an impoverished farming population that overseas countries are trying to make things much worse for them.
We are under tremendous pressure from Australia and also New Zealand to open up our borders to allow for cheaper imports coming in for those countries and in the name of global competitiveness. Now, that is unfortunate because we would like to protect our farmers. There's nothing wrong in protecting our farmers. We have their livelihood depends upon cultivating those crops. They can't be thrown out. They can't be thrown out. Although I agree completely that Indian's sugar industry is highly pampered, and I have been, we have been fighting against that in India. We have been saying that whether it was regulated or whether it is now free, the industry is the most pampered, in this country, sugar industry. And as a result of which, for the first time, I find that we have set up a minimum price of sugar, 29 rupees. You know, everywhere in the world, we are saying the industry should be globally competitive, which means if the prices go down, we are happy. But in the case of sugar, why are we ensuring that prices should not go down? It's something that we have been also demanding in India.
Australian farmers produce some pretty good sugar, and their issue in this case is that because of various signals, Indian farmers have produced too much, and now the government is giving payments to mills that specifically encourage them to export more of this glut onto the market, and that's the issue here. So they've sent the problem overseas, essentially.
Well, as I said earlier, there were flaws in WTO. Let's accept it. And I think we need to renegotiate WTO now. And these kinds of clashes that are coming up internationally, between various bilaterally, also between some countries, is increasing over the last few years. And we are aware of that. But the point here is very clear that India has to protect its industry. I'm not saying that within the country we should, we have been also debating whether the more production should go to sugar or why not an equal kind of production to other sectors, sections of the farming community which is engaged in other crops. That is something which we are deliberating in India. But internationally, I think we have the right to protect our interests, just like America has the right to protect its interests.
So overall, based on the protests that we saw this week, do you think the farmers have walked away from New Delhi feeling like their voice has been heard?
I don't think so. I think like the number of protests we have seen this year and also previous years, the farmers come to New Delhi with an expectation, which unfortunately has remained unfulfilled so far. And I don't see that they will get an immediate recourse to what they've been demanding, neither in the short term nor in the long term. But I think it has at least brought the debate again on the forefront as to the terrible agrarian crisis that prevails in the country and the need to provide an immediate focus to it. And because the elections, the general elections in India are due 2019, mid of 2019, we will see now more of such kind of protest happening in the country. And perhaps for the first time, I can't be sure, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, perhaps for the first time we will see agriculture on the top of the political agenda, which means all political parties would be forced to talk about agriculture. And I think that's a positive development, because in a democracy, that's what you can do.
Can you just outline your thoughts a bit more on what it is specifically farmers need? Because an Australian farmer hearing this, who doesn't receive any subsidies, who is pretty much left to take the global price, they'd look at an Indian farmer who does receive subsidies and, you know, there's a lot of government's interference in the market and say that that farmer is probably being looked after a lot more if the government's always going to step in when the price sinks below a level. And
well, I remember some years back I was travelling in Australia, and I remember that Australian farmers were very upset with the potatoes coming in from New Zealand. Why were they upset? If they were playing by the rules, they were upset because it distorted their market, and many of them would have been thrown out. So the point I'm trying to make is Australia is no, an icon of virtues, you know, and they also wanted to protect their market. So I think we also want to protect our market. Now the point that we need to understand is between Australia and India, the average landholding size in India is 1.3 hectares. Ask any Australian farmer if he can farm in 1.3 hectares. You know, you have miles and miles of ranges and so on, and that's the kind of the issue of scale that we are faced with. You know, on the other hand, we have a small farmer who is just 1.3 hectares. Look at him. He has to also see that his family survives year after year. Why do you want him to be globally competitive? I don't want him to be globally competitive. I want to take care of his family. Or let him be globally competitive, let Australian farmers take care of our Indian farmers' families. You know, it can't be this way that, you know, if it benefits you, if it benefits Australian farmers, the Indian farmers must suffer for that. I think this is something which has been completely wrong as far as the WTO was concerned in forcing it onto us.
Right. Well, just finally, Devinder, with elections, as you mentioned, happening next year, if Australia, Brazil, and maybe Thailand start a dispute process at the WTO, with respect to this issue, what do you think is going to be more concerning to the government, dealing with a complaint in the WTO or keeping his farmers happy?
Well, I think governments may want to keep its commitment to WTO, but they have a huge, huge constituency back home. I don't think any government in India can afford to annoy its farmers and or try to see that their livelihoods are destroyed. That will be politically suicidal. And I think the WTO also has to draw a lesson and learn a lesson that they can't be forcing their unjust agenda onto us. I don't think any political party for that matter can dare to annoy Indian farmers. We are 600 million farmers, and I think we are the largest country with the largest number of farmers in the world, and I think their voice has to be heard.
Indian agricultural economist and trade policy analyst Devinder Sharma speaking with me just as those protests were called off on Wednesday night our time. Changing gears now, you might know it's pretty classic to pair a red wine with a steak, or that Margaret River is known for its Chardonnay. But how much do you know about the specific flavours of a Southwest WA olive oil, and what food that would go well with? Just like wine, olive oil has different flavours depending on where it's grown. And as Tyne Logan discovered, olive producers in Australia are trying to capitalise on that.
Our olive oils tend to be a mid-level oil. They're not too strong, not too light in flavour. They're good. They're good oils to use in any aspect. So they're not robust, but they're good flavoursome oils. You know, they always taste fresh. Got a grassy note to them.
That's the way Mick Ryan from Preston Valley describes the flavour profile of the olive oil he produces in Donnybrook in the southwest. And if new research by the Queensland Olive Council is anything to go by, that flavour will be unique to his region. The association has just wrapped up a feasibility study into the profitability of creating a geographical origin system for Australian olive growers, similar to that of the wine industry. Dr. Richard Goll is a sensory scientist, olive oil judge, and was the principal researcher on this project, and he says there's a big difference in olive oil from region to region.
I've been chairman of the Australian Extra Virgin Olive Oil competition for over 15 years, and one of the most common questions was, is extra virgin olive oil different from region to region? And I had to say, I mean, my gut feeling that it was, because I could actually pick differences in olive oil myself, but we didn't have any evidence for that. So we put together a project to see whether or not we could validate what I thought was what was true.
And could you?
Yes, we did. We got olive growers from the Fleurieu Peninsula in South Australia, which is the area just south of Adelaide, and we got olive growers from southeast Queensland in the higher parts around Toowoomba and in the Burnett Valley just below that, and we showed that they were different, which was that these were all from the same variety as well, which was important.
How big was the difference?
What we found was that although the olives were coming from the two regions, they were the same variety, and they were picked at the same ripeness, and they were processed in exactly the same way, they had a unique chemical fingerprint. When I say chemical fingerprint, I mean in terms of their things like polyphenols, which are important for health. There's another compound called squalene, which is actually also very healthy for you, and another compound called tocopherol, which is a type of vitamin E. And we found that between the two regions, there were differences in basically the profile of these compounds. And also, when we tasted the oils, they actually tasted different.
You said you are an olive oil judge, though, as well. Do you have a particularly good palate when it comes to telling the difference between olive oils? Is this something that the general consumer would be able to tell the difference between as well?
When we did the taste testing of the oils from the two regions, we used growers from the two regions as our tasting panel. And, you know, the growers are pretty good tasters, but they're not, you know, they're sort of halfway between super experts and naive consumers. So I think it was a pretty good taste test.
It's a difference that Amanda Bailey from the Queensland Olive Council says producers need to capitalise on.
So we actually found out that about 94% of growers would be able to benefit from this single estate / provenance type class. We also found that anywhere else in the world where a designation of origin had been defined, that producers there typically gained higher prices for their products as opposed to when they weren't defined. We worked out that, yeah, it would cost about 4 cents per litre to be able to implement a provenance type system throughout the olive industry.
And what's the higher price that you'd get per litre?
Well, in some areas, you know, and it's like cheeses and things like that, you know, like consumers will pay a premium price for something that they know is authentic. And so, you know, in some cases, you know, the prices were as much as 50% higher.
They're also setting up a website that will help consumers in their buying decisions.
One of the first questions is how do I find my local producer? So that's hopefully going to help answer some of those questions. And from that, you know, we'll be able to come up as an industry with a whole heap of different materials to help consumers understand a bit more about the diversity, because the diversity of olive oil is as diverse in flavour profile as wine.
And will there be a way for consumers to know what nuttier olive oil, for instance, would go with compared to a sweeter olive oil, how they should use the different flavours?
Yeah, so through the website, that's also something that we want to do is have food pairing, is to actually be able to show consumers how to use olive oil better, you know, from a culinary sense, you know, with different things that they're making at home. So, yeah, we hope that, you know, it's like when you have, say, a dinner party, you don't have the one wine necessarily. You know, there's a wine that goes particularly with that dish better than what it would with, say, something else. And olive oil is exactly the same in that way as well.
Well, it's still a while off and there's still plenty more studies to be done. It's news that certainly got the industry excited. Here's producer Mick Ryan again.
Yeah, I think anything that can help promote, you know, regional oils is good for the region and it's good for the industry. Our oil's different to oils up from Gingin, say, or down in the Great Southern. I think anything that helps identify the origin of oils is going to be a benefit.
That was WA olive oil producer Mick Ryan ending that report from Tyne Logan.